To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
The destiny prescribed by Franklin Roosevelt called for a bold break with the old order. For a short time, Congress went along, bringing sweeping changes in public policy. But during FDR's second term, conservative Southern Democrats began rebelling against the enormous expansion in federal power promoted by their party's president. This rebellion continued through the 40s and 50s in the Truman and Eisenhower administrations, making life particularly complicated for House Speaker Sam Rayburn.
There's a tendency these days to try to recall Sam Rayburn as a martinet or an all-powerful speaker who could crack the whip and get the votes anytime he wanted, but that wasn't the case. He had to struggle for almost every vote.
With John F. Kennedy's election as president in 1960, the tide began to slowly turn.
It took everything together to make it happen. You had to have Rayburn leading the fight. You had to have Kennedy putting everything he had into it. You had to have all the interest groups mobilized.
Still, Kennedy was often stymied in getting his domestic policies accepted by Congress. Time and again, the conservative coalition took the wind out of his sails, particularly with his initiatives in civil rights and Medicare.
To achieve progress without strife, to achieve change without hatred, not without difference of opinion, but without the deep and abiding divisions which scar the Union for generations.
The Johnson administration fared better with conservatives in Congress. The 1964 elections brought more Northern Democrats to Capitol Hill, giving Johnson a voting cushion to finally pass civil rights bills and his Great Society programs. The conservative coalition gained momentum once more during the Nixon years. Nixon resurrected the old coalition to his advantage, gaining conservative support on such issues as law and order and the Vietnam War. Even though he was a Southerner, Jimmy Carter had his own troubles with the Democratic conservatives.
As a matter of fact, during all those years, there wasn't a formality about conservative Democrats. There was an existence of a kind of coalitional activity from time to time. Our former colleague Joe Wagner was considered to some extent the unofficial head of the Southern Conservative Coalition. It wasn't until the beginning of President Reagan's administration that there was a formation of an actual organization.
This new generation of Southern Conservative Democrats, known as boll weevils, even gave President Reagan a tie. It sported their trademark, the boll weevil insect, a kind of beetle known to destroy Southern crops and liberal legislation in Congress. While the group's tactics were the same, the issues facing these conservatives were different.
This philosophical coalition is founded on a bedrock of economic issues. Now, much of the boll weevil movement that basically governed this country on and off from the turn of the century until the early 1960s, much of that was based on other issues, regionalism, the race issue.
Texas Congressman Phil Graham was one of the Southern Democrats' leaders. Along with his fellow Texans, Charles Stenholm and Kent Hance, he formed an organization called the Conservative Democratic Forum. Unlike the original rebels, this group was clearly organized and recognized by all sides as the key to victory. They were lured by both party leaderships during the economic battles of 1981 and 82, but they saw themselves as representative of the nation at large.
I think the Democratic Forum speaks for the bulk of the American people, whether they be Democratic or Republican or independents. And I'm ready to declare myself in that regard.
Enough Southern Democrats joined with Republicans to declare themselves for President Reagan in 1981, and his economic program passed. But by 1982, the coalition wasn't working as well. Changing issues prompted one political analyst to predict that the old-time conservative coalition wouldn't be recognizable for long.
These issues are no longer prime issues. They've been replaced by issues of environment, issues on the economy, issues of energy, issues of defense spending, which don't neatly divide Northern and Southern Democrats in the same way as the old series of issues, or don't neatly divide liberals and conservatives in the same way.
Norm, why did the conservative coalition do so well in 1981 and very much less well in 82?
Well, that'd be focused here mostly on the Southern Democrats. But the real key to the conservative coalition in 1981 was the almost perfect Republican unity right after Ronald Reagan got elected. By 1982, an election year, some moderate Republicans were getting leery of the budget cuts and voted with the Democrats, and there went the great conservative coalition.
Do you think it'll come back?
Well, I think we'll always see divisions in the Democratic Party that'll bring some sort of cross-party coalition of conservatives. But the South is changing and issues are changing, so we're likely to see shifting coalitions in the future.
Most voters, I suppose, are not likely to be aware of coalitions or of the patterns that emerge from the hundreds of votes their representatives cast each year. But interest groups do follow those votes, especially on issues that concern them. To identify their friends and their adversaries, many groups compile records and ratings of legislators. Now, these groups are as diverse as the issues themselves. They involve the environment, morality, defense, labor, and the consumer.
I always say my record is great. My opponent always says it's terrible. For instance, I haven't missed a vote for 16 years. My opponent says we'd have a better country if I'd missed them all.
Still, most lawmakers know that a lot of their votes are not going to be noticed by constituents. But some individual votes will be. And so, possibly, will the blanket ratings of voting records prepared by groups like the Consumer Federation of America, who use them to highlight their foes and their champions.
Before you today are the members who stood steadfastly for the pocketbooks of the people back home. They were confronted with some very basic choices, choices that brought with them great political danger. Yet they stood with us.
Each year, the Consumer Federation of America prepares a report card on every lawmaker's votes on key consumer issues. And then they publicly laud the heroes with perfect records on these consumer votes.
When they were asked to choose between powerful natural gas producers and the people who have to pay skyrocketing gas bills, they chose the people. When they were asked to choose between used car dealers and the people who are often forced to endure not only poor quality cars, but out-and-out misrepresentations as well, they chose the people.
But applauding the heroes means criticizing the zeros.
And while we are very proud of our heroes, that's the reason we're having this press conference, we must admit that they were outnumbered by what we call the zeros, members who failed to cast even one right vote. In the Senate, zeros outnumbered perfect scores 4-2. In the House, the zeros dominated 24-6.
The heroes this year were all Democrats, and the zeros Republicans. And so the news conference had a decidedly partisan flavor.
I understand a smaller ceremony is being planned later in a phone booth to present the Republican consumer heroes.
A positive rating on consumer votes can be valuable to politicians who are thinking ahead to their next election.
And if you have a high record on the Consumer Federation of America, that means you're going to have a low record on some Chamber of Commerce or some special interest roll call record, the AMA perhaps, or some other like that. And you need this to overcome it and to convince people that you really are representing the public interest, the broad interest, and not a special interest that makes campaign contributions and buys their legislation.
News of Senator Proxmire's support on consumer issues traveled quickly from Washington to Wisconsin, where local consumer advocates staged yet another news conference to name Proxmire a hero.
There's no award I would rather have than this one, because this is one that represents all the people. You know, everybody's a consumer. And I take great pride in the fact that that I try to represent the people and not vested special interest groups.
Hawkins, Democrat. Wrong, right.
To back up this publicity, Consumer Federation clerks and researchers in Washington pored over congressional votes, checking and double-checking their vote tallies.
You'll talk to people on the Hill, you'll talk to other interest groups, we'll talk internally as a staff, and we have to make sure that the votes that we pick don't just look important, but that they really were important.
The rating process is not just to highlight individual records. The Federation tries to use it as well to influence legislation.
One of the things we'd like to do better is let people know ahead of time when a voting record vote is coming up, because we think that matters to them, and we think that that will change a few votes.
Consumers aren't the only group to keep tabs on lawmakers' votes. More than 70 national pressure groups now rate congressional records, from church groups to small business. The rating game achieved political notoriety in the 1970s with the Dirty Dozen campaign, a controversial attempt to defeat 12 members of Congress who were targeted as anti-environmental. With negative campaigns on the rise, lawmakers today have developed systems of self-defense, as Congressman Barbara Conable explained.
The way to handle a rating of that sort is to deal with the specific issues involved and explain why you voted. You know, folks will forgive you for how you vote frequently if you voted that way for good reason. The way to get in trouble is not to know why you voted the way you did. And any congressman that's unwilling to explain his vote has got to be a pretty shallow fellow indeed.
The way that votes are cast and counted, the actual mechanics of the process, is a matter of some importance. In the Senate, most votes are old-fashioned roll calls. The clerk calls the roll aloud, then repeats the names of non-voters a second and perhaps a third time to give them every chance to vote. As a result, a Senate roll call can take as long as 45 minutes. The House, with four times the Senate membership, also used to vote that way, taking even longer. But in 1973, the House installed a computerized tally system that allows members to record their yeas and nays electronically. New members take the system for granted. Older members know that it makes a considerable difference.
Mr. Frenzel, what purpose do you rise?
Mr. Speaker, I ask for a recorded vote.
Gentlemen, ask for a recorded vote. Those in favor will rise. More than required amount having arisen, the yeas and nays are ordered. Those in favor vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. Voting will be by electronic device.
Nowadays, lawmakers use plastic ID cards to register their votes at machines located around the floor. During the 15 minutes while votes are tabulated, running tallies are listed on electronic scoreboards above the floor. Most days, the system works just fine, improving the speed and efficiency of House proceedings. But one day in 1981, the electronic voting machines broke down, creating a commotion on the House floor.
The clerk will call the roll in the traditional manner. Members will not submit ballot cards. They will respond to when their name is called.
Mr. Alexander.
No.
Mr. Alexander votes no. Mr. Anderson.
No one was more surprised than freshman House members who had never voted the old-fashioned way. While lawmakers milled about, the acting speaker, George Danielson of California, and the House clerk tried to get the votes counted.
Will the members kindly cooperate by being as quiet as possible? I know this is a new experience for many of the members, but it's a ritual of the House. Will the members kindly hold their voices down and the clerk will continue?
That one experience with the leisurely pace of an old-fashioned roll call has not been repeated. With the shorter votes, and many more of them these days, there's a lot more running on Capitol Hill. Members rush to the floor with clocks ticking off the time remaining to make those votes. Electronic voting has also changed how people vote. It enables members to calculate the politics of their decision up to the last minute.
You can go to the House floor and look how a lot of other people have voted already. You get an idea of how the vote stands. You get an idea of whether the vote is going to be an important one, a close one, one you have to watch very critically, or whether it's one you can throw away.
Political scientist Bruce Oppenheimer has studied how changes in the voting process have changed the way that party leaders behave on the floor.
It does provide the leadership one advantage. And that is they now have electronic facilities which enable them to track who has voted, when they have voted, who hasn't voted. And it gives them an idea, a better idea, during a roll call vote as to who they still need to contact and whether they're going to need people who are marginal on a given vote.
The consensus, however, is that the House leadership loses leverage under the modern method. With only 15 minutes and no public calling of names, there's not much opportunity for arm twisting.
Opinion of the chair, the noes have it.
That asks for yeas and nays.
Gentlemen, ask for the yeas and nays. More than the required amount having arisen, the yeas and nays are ordered.
With electronic voting, you can pop onto the floor and put your card in the slot and push the button and leave. And you're inaccessible to people who think that you should be demonstrating greater teamwork than you are.
New York Congressman Barbara Conable, an 18-year veteran of the House, was a leader in the movement to reform voting methods and open up votes for public record. Conable says that these and other reforms carry a price, but he views the changes positively.
It is true that that we don't have a Sam Rayburn now who can go down to the White House and say, this is what my boys will do, or this is what my boys won't do. Nobody can speak for the Congress anymore. But I think that's a salubrious development. I think it's desirable that every congressman has to go on record pretty clearly for what he's going to do. The bells are ringing right now.
Much that goes on in Congress is a prelude to action. Congressional committees and subcommittees sift through the mountain of bills introduced each session, winnowing out the many thousands that will get nowhere, considering and reporting out the few hundred that will. Then the parliamentary process brings forth the rules for debate and decision on the surviving legislation. At the end of this twisting trail come the final decisions, votes on the floor of the House and Senate. The votes themselves are the decisive steps in the legislative process for national policy and for the legislators' records. As Barbara Conable said, when voting time comes, members of Congress have to say yes or no. They can't say maybe. I'm Edwin Newman.